I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today on Spark My Muse, I welcome professor at Eternity Bible College and the author of a number of books, often controversial in nature, on hell and homosexuality and violence and nonviolence, Preston Sprinkle. He joins me today. Thank you so much, Preston, for joining me.
Thanks for having me on, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be here.
So one of the reasons I wanted to make sure we could have a conversation is that I have noticed, and as many people have noticed, the sharp uptick in violence, whether it's been through police brutality and the Black Lives Matter movement or overseas in the Middle East. There's been so much struggle with ISIS and Syria. And then even in political rallies, there's been, at least in my lifetime, I don't remember that political rallies have had this level of violence at them. And people who appear to be running as Christians or even conservative Christians have called for carpet bombing and blowing up our enemies and ramping up our military. And I was looking around to see who has really poured some thought into this, who has researched the Bible and a case for what should we do about violence in the world, and from a Christian perspective, what should we do? And when I came across your book, Fight, the Christian case for against nonviolence, I'm just butchered up your title pretty badly there.
<That's okay.
laughs> Yeah, I got my merds wixed. So I wanted to see if we could speak to that in a more thoughtful way, and a podcast is kind of a great way to do that. So maybe I should ask you first, what drew you to even write about the topic in the first place a few years back?
Yeah, it's a good question. If you asked me 10 years ago if I ever would have written a book like this, I would have thought you're crazy. I mean, I wasn't I'm kind of a strange advocate for nonviolence because I wasn't raised in a so-called peacemaking church. I was raised in a heavy, I would say, militaristic evangelical subculture. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny that it's not even like it's articulated. It's just like mm-hmm. there. I remember as mm-hmm. a teenager and I was a quasi-Christian as a teenager, you know, kind of partying, living it up, still saying I'm a Christian. And I still remember hearing about a professor at a local city college that claimed to be a Christian and a pacifist. Mm-hmm. And I remember as a teenager rolling my eyes and saying, well, that's a contradiction. Like, you can't be a Christian and a pacifist. Like, pacifists are liberals, they probably kill babies. Well, that doesn't make sense. But they have all these weird images. And I don't even know where that came from. It's like, it's there in the air of evangelicalism. And it's hard to even identify. Like, I don't remember hearing anybody saying, oh yeah, Christians can't be pacifists, whatever. It was just the culture I was raised in, that Christians kill their enemies. Like, that's what we do. Somebody steps on our toes, we, you know, hit them back twice as hard. And that's just, you know, that's what Jesus would do, you know? Like,
not turn the other cheek. He would actually blow them away with an AK-47, like Rambo.
the most common response, Christian response, after the command, turn the other cheek, is always, but. it's not okay. It's not amen. It's, yeah, but, you know, it's like, well, that doesn't really work. So there's got to be some other meaning here. And so I remember years later, I mean, way after I became a born again Christian and started studying the Bible and then going to grad school and doing my PhD, I went through my entire PhD and never really even questioned that sort of militaristic narrative. Well, maybe it's towards the end of that. I wasn't researching this topic, but I mean, just in studying the Bible. And finally, when I did start looking into the topic more fairly, I was like, wow, this Christian, this Jesus person, like, he said some pretty radical things about violence that how have I never heard this, or how have people around me, you know, never really advocated for this? And then when I began an in-depth study of what the Bible says about it, I was like, it's fascinating for two reasons. Number one, that the Christian ethic regarding violence and nonviolence is super countercultural. It's not what you would expect to do with your enemies. You know, love your enemies is not a normal thing to do. And secondly, I was just blown away at how many evangelicals not only didn't advocate for it, but seemed to be very anti-peacemaking and anti-nonviolence and to be very militaristic. And that was really troubling for me. So that's when I said, I'm probably going to get a lot of flack for writing this book, fortunately, because Christians aren't going to like it.
Yeah.
Even though it's like saturated with the Bible. But I don't care. This is just ridiculous that more people aren't talking about this and evangelicals.
Yeah. And, you know, I know exactly what you mean. Growing up in the 80s as a teenager, Ronald Reagan was the president. And now, I just told you basically how old I am. Then that was a very much like watch out for the commies and nuclear war. And you really felt like you had to have this huge military to protect yourself. And it seemed very patriotic. Being a Christian was also to be patriotic, I guess. They were really linked. It was very cultural, not biblical, cultural. And then they really got linked. In my graduate school days, though, I had a lot of connection with Anabaptists. And I realized that not everybody thinks that that's true. You know, there's people who refrain from voting and are definitely, they won't do military service. And it's really different based on their ideas of what kingdom come means.
Right.
And so I'm sure that in your studies, you were probably reading Yoder and some of these pacifist Christians who see things very differently.
You know, what's funny is in my research, like I know how evangelicalism works. It's in my bones. It's in my blood. I get it. And I knew that I would get accused by being kind of persuaded from reading all these pacifists if I came out with this view. So I actually purposely didn't read hardly any pacifists. All I did is read the Bible and study the Bible on an exegetical level. Now, to be clear, because Yoder is a biblical scholar and was doing biblical work, I did read, I think, one book by Yoder. But like, for instance, I never read anything by Stanley Hauerwas.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't read... there's a really good book by Greg Boyd called The Myth of a Christian Nation. I purposely didn't read it because I was like, I know he's really persuasive and I know I'll probably end up agreeing with it, but I don't want to crack the book so that people could say, what, Greg Boyd just persuaded you? I'm like, no, you know, Paul, Jesus persuaded me, you know? So
yeah.
I have since now kind of read some of that stuff and been pleasantly surprised that their, you know, interpretation of the Bible is, you know, what I was finding as well. So, so I tried to preempt some of that.
Yeah, I see what you mean, because you wanted to go in with and just see what you found for yourself. But then as you've read these other scholars, you feel like you basically concur with them and you came to the same conclusions, or?
Yeah, Greg Boyd's book. I mean, I honestly had to put it down just because I was highlighting every line of it saying like, yeah. I mean, you know, what's funny is I'm almost scared I'd get accused of plagiarism because his book came out long before mine, but I can honestly say before God and my nation that I never read that book before I wrote mine, but there's like almost whole sentences that sound very similar there. So yeah, it's very reassuring that people are looking at the scriptures and seeing the same thing. And, you know, it's funny how, you know, when I'm wrestling with the New Testament and I invite pushback, I invite, you know, what am I missing here and what am I not seeing? And and it's been like, I don't want to simplify it, but I mean, I haven't really received that many really like hard pushbacks to this view. The only pushback I get is like, well, what, if somebody breaks into your house, you're just going to watch them rape your family? You know, like, well, I'm like, that's, we can go there, but that's not like a biblical argument. We have to read the Bible. We're Christians, right? We have to read the Bible first and then and then answer ethical questions like that. People are like, oh, I never thought of that. And it's like, really? Like, you go to the Bible for all your other views, but when it comes to violence, you just jump to somebody breaking into your home, you know, where violence, you know, the assumption is that violence is the only way to stop somebody, which that's not the real world. That's not a real scenario where it's like a zero-sum game between use violence or not use violence. That's the only options, you know? So I was surprised though that a lot of people that read the book, even if they didn't agree all with me all the way, which is fine. I mean, there's layers of complications with the discussion, but a lot of people were like, people I didn't expect kind of resonating with the general message there. Mm. So that's been really exciting too and hopeful.
Yeah, I would think you'd actually get more pushback because I know people who, you know, I live in an area where everybody has a gun, mostly for hunting. And, you know, there's some people who have like, a, you know, open carry, you know, stuff like that. I'm always like, oh, whatever. You know, a lot of people are hunters and, you know, they enjoy paying like $139 a pound for deer meat and stuff. But it's more like kind of don't take that off the table if I want to be violent. Because, and so they will say, I'll hear arguments like, well, what about the Old Testament? There's all kinds of violence. There's all kinds of killing. And what about that? Are you saying that, you know, God said to kill all these people and that happened and God said to do that? And, you know, we look to our culture now and we say, we're imposing our culture on the Bible now and coming up with stuff. And then we look to the culture then and say, what did it not happen then too?
Right.
I mean, I think that there's a cultural imposition on the scriptures then too. And I don't know how you see it. Right. What do you say when people say, what about the Old Testament? What about the genocide? You know?
Yeah, I devoted, I think 3 or maybe 4 chapters just to the Old Testament because I did. Again, I don't like the term conservative. I'm a Bible believing Christian, so I want to take the Bible very seriously. I don't want to just write it off. And I was kind of seeing that in some people. You know, they kind of like, well, that's the Old Testament, move on. I'm like, well, no, I don't. I believe Jesus loved the Old Testament, and the New Testament is, you know, flows from the Old. So we do have to deal with this. But even there, that's kind of I hear that all the time too. Like, what about the Old Testament? We have a genocide in the Old Testament. Like, so wait a minute. Are you saying that we should be genocidal then? Like,
yeah.
Like, what does that even mean? Like, people just kind of say violence is in the Old Testament, and then they leap across several logical hurdles and land on, therefore I can kill my enemy if he breaks into the home, or therefore we should nuke ISIS. I'm like, whoa. That's just, I don't care if you're an atheist or a Christian, that's just sloppy reasoning right there. But here's the thing, is every single Christian is going to believe that there is at least some, if not a lot, of ethical discontinuities between the Old and New Testament. And I know that because I've never met a Christian who went to church with a lamb over his shoulder or who, you know, believes that you can't eat shrimp. Well, some do. you know, look at some of the laws regarding adultery. You know, it's go out and stone the adulterer, disobedient kids and stone them. And you have, polygamy laws, like, hey, if you have two wives, then make sure you don't favor the wife that you love the most and neglect the son of the unloved wife. The end. You know, it's like, wait a minute. So there's all kinds of ethical stuff in the Old Testament that every single Christian, let's say 99% of Christians, are going to say, yeah, that's not really the way Christians should act today. Mm-hmm. And all I argue in a book, now this is a very simplified, obviously, summary, and I spend, again, probably 80 chapters articulating this, but 80 chapters. 80.
It's not that long.
It's a really big book. really short chapters. So the short answer is that violence, the violence that's commanded in the Old Testament, which not all violence is commanded in the Old Testament, by the way. So some of it just happens. Mm-hmm. But the violence that is commanded in the Old Testament belongs on this sort of ethical trajectory alongside a sort of patriarchal view of women, slavery, polygamy, and other things. And it was never intended to be the sort of lasting law for all of God's people of all time. It was an ethic that God gave to Israel. And it was, as many scholars who aren't pacifists would say, it was a tolerated ethic. It was something God sort of, he met Israel where they were at, and yet didn't intend to leave them there or to give them some sort of eternal law regarding violence. And so what you see in the Old Testament is a trajectory moving away from violence. Look at the prophets, Isaiah, Micah. I mean, they were like, they came down pretty hard against using violence against the nations and trusting in military might. And so when we get to Jesus, he simply is at the top end of that trajectory, revealing the ultimate ethic of nonviolence.
And so your case against violence, and you like to use it, you like to differentiate between pacifism and nonviolence, yeah. which we could get into in a second. But your case is really that a Christian can't build a biblical case for violence. You know, that you really can't build one. You really can't build a logical case for violence, and that to do so is to just kind of be living out a contradiction. And so we'll explore like some practical stuff later, because it's kind of, it's one thing to sort of say that in sort of an academic sense, like presenting a paper, and I'm with you on it. I think you're right, but then it's kind of like, but sure. Then what about this? And then maybe you could talk a little bit about what do you think the difference is between pacifism and a nonviolent answer to violence?
So yeah, the first one, I personally advocate for what's called absolute nonviolence, meaning I don't think violence is ever justified. But let me follow that up really quickly with I believe that the position of absolute violence, I think that is a tough one. I think there are some difficult things to get that position. And so I'm very in my book, I don't by any stretch think that everybody should read the Bible and be committed to absolute nonviolence, no problem. Like that is a mm-hmm. a sort of more radical position within my camp. But here's my main burden. My number one burden is that evangelicalism, beginning from the 60s and, well, 70s, especially the 80s, and on in through today, is not just, yeah, I will use violence as a last resort. We are militaristic. We have, you know, it's come to a head. You know, people are like shocked that all these evangelicals are supporting Donald Trump. This isn't shocking to me at all. I'm shrugging my shoulders saying he represents what is lying beneath the skin of evangelicals and what's been there for years. Mm-hmm. This isn't a shock. He, you know, again, I think back in my early evangelicalism days, and I totally would have voted for, like, he was like, oh yeah, that's a man of God. Like, that's what we should be, tough. We should, you know, don't be pushed around. We should kind of bully our enemies and or even those who disagree. Like, yeah, winning is the ultimate goal. Like, that's just the evangelical subculture on the whole. Obviously, not everybody, but you have Jerry Falwell Jr., who is in charge. He's the leader of the largest Christian institution in the history of the world. Mm. You add up all the students, you add up all the faculty, you add up all the administrators, all the alumni. He's the leader of the largest Christian institution in the history of the world. And he told his students to arm themselves so that they can kill Muslims before they kill us. That's not using violence as a last resort. That is hyper militarism, almost jihadist. I mean, that is crazy. Mm. That, if you read the, well, anyway, I don't want to keep going, but and then you have, you know, Pat Robertson and other so-called evangelical leaders that are like, yeah, this is awesome. This is the way we should be. And that to me is the problem. The problem isn't that Christians might be willing as a lesser of two evils, you know, use violence as a very last resort and repent later, you know, against an enemy and mourn over the enemy that they had to kill as a last resort. If that was the ultimate extent of violence in evangelicalism, I would say, okay, that's fine. For the, you know, few hundred people in America where this might happen to, okay, whatever. The problem is that we have a deep and, well, yeah, a deep and wide militaristic spirit in evangelicalism. There was, real quickly, and I'll get to your second point, Andrew Bosovich is a military historian, and he has a book called The New American Militarism. Mm. And in that chapter, he has a whole chapter on the evangelical influence on our militaristic nation. And he has a quote, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't have it in front of me, but he says, were it not for the tens of millions of evangelicals supporting a militaristic state, militarism in America would have been inconceivable. He locates the main engine behind our hyper-militaristic Trump-supporting nation. I mean, this is pre-Trump, but in evangelicalism. And I think that is where the problem lies.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. It's really strange. I think it really is more of a reflection, not really of Christianity or of Jesus or the Bible even, or even of a God who believes, not of a God who believes, but a God who has made us and our lives are precious to him.
Yeah.
But of an American culture that is saturated with individualism and, taking care of yourself and, you know, arm yourself. And that's really where, that's why the Second Amendment fits so nicely in with our values as Americans, right? So you should be able to have a holster and something in there. I heard a guy one time say to me in a law enforcement officer say to me, if we didn't all have guns, China would have overrun us by now. I loved it, but I kind of thought, really? I don't know. They might have other things to do. And so it's just the mentality of we have to be ready for all things. We're just about to get attacked. And besides pairing that with Christianity, which is kind of like, and God's on our side, is an extra problem. But there's a lot to contend with. But in getting to the practical end, things like the Second Amendment and things like, do we serve in the military and what do we do about, how do we stop ISIS as Christians when they are, you know, we can't really, I don't think, justify stopping violence with violence, but what do you suppose is the answer then?
Well, and with all these practical questions, I think there's going to be gray. I think there's going to be disagreement. And I certainly don't have all the answers to that. I'm not a political theorist, so I don't know all the ins and outs of all that stuff.
There's no like Preston Sprinkle for president going on.
No. But with ISIS, it's interesting, and I read a little bit in sort of contemporary politics, but not a lot at all. But it seems that ISIS was indirectly created by the CIA. Like, we actually had a hand in creating ISIS.
Arming them, basically, by arming Iraq. And
So I want to step back and say, okay, rather than just look at the wound and see what Band-Aid we can put on it, let's see what's causing the wound. Like, I think that's a question that needs to be raised. It's like, okay, so we help create this thing, and then we turn around and say, oh, they kind of went bad, let's go kill them. It's like, let's back up and say, what are we doing that is causing this? And if you look at history in the Cold War era, this is something that I have looked into in more detail. I mean, the CIA is responsible for establishing all kinds of ruthless dictators and for causing all kinds of democratic societies to crumble. You know, if you add up the civilian death toll caused directly or indirectly by America in the last 60 years, civilian death toll, it comes to about 6 million civilians that we have indirectly killed by establishing anti-communist dictators in Latin America and other countries. And by causing other democratic states to crumble because they, were being influenced by the Soviet Union, whatever. It's like, wait a minute.
Oh,
so I always get the question, what do we do with Hitler? I'm like, well, what do we do with us?
Yeah, we've kind of created, we've done as much damage as Hitler.
Totally. Yeah. And so are we strap bombs and go bomb Langley? I mean, just the inconsistency and the blindness of endorsing this sort of hyper pro American narrative is like, there's bad people everywhere killing civilians everywhere. It's a whole huge mess. So it's not the question of what do we do with ISIS. It's one question in a larger subset of what are we doing as a country, That's one. Secondly, as much as logically, I would say, okay, if I leave aside my Christian ethic, okay, I would say, yeah, it just seems like you just carpet bomb ISIS, just take them all out, but it's like, wait, we've have a history of fighting bad people with violence. How's that going for us? I don't think you know, I don't think that violence always necessarily begets violence. That's a common Mennonite kind of phrase. And I think for the most part, that's probably true. But I don't want to say violence always begets violence. But it often does. And I don't think violence has a really good track record of solving evil. You know, well, it worked in World War II. Well, yeah, that created the Cold War, and it created all kinds of power vacuums throughout the world, and it gave rise to all kinds of junk. All the stuff in the Middle East going on today, and all this hatred of America is because we have been, you know, establishing horrible dictators over there and funding this and that. And and so it's not like violence just solved World War II, the good war, you know, it's like that just led to all kinds of other stuff. So if we carpet bomb ISIS, I doubt we would say, okay, let's wipe our hands, you know, shake off the dust, close in prayer, now we have peace. Like, no, there's, it's not going to solve evil in the world. Jesus is the only solution to evil in the world. So as much as I don't have an answer, I don't think that the clear answer is just nuke them off the face of the earth. That's just historically, that's very naive to think that would just solve all these problems.
Yeah, it is so complicated. And during these, some of these like presidential debates, it was like, you know, oh, let's shrink our military. And it's like, ah, let's grow our military. Let's give up to these guys. Let's give up to these guys. Or let's go in, let's put troops on the ground. I kept thinking, I am so glad I don't have to make those decisions. Every single thing they're putting out there, I can think of like 10 horrendous consequences of everything that they've put out there. And I'm so glad I don't have to be responsible for making that decision, because it is incredibly complicated. And yet, as Christians, we are, you know, I really think of it in an Ignatian spiritual lens, which is that we are part of God's divine project to bring healing into the world, right?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so we have to be part of the solution, which is never going to be involve bullets, you know, it's never going to involve. And so does that mean, you know, my daughter told me the other day, I don't know if she's going to see it through. She's like, I want to join the Air Force. And she's a middle schooler. So, but she's like, and I thought, oh, crap. Like, I don't know what that means. And I don't know if she'll give that idea up tomorrow. But it's like, I don't. You know, what our responsibility is as Christians in the world and bringing healing to the world. What does that mean, and what can that involve? It is something that we have to individually wrestle with, and how we are in the world.
Yeah. So I've got a friend named Jeremy Court. He's the leader of a really neat organization called Preemptive Love. And he's over, him and his family, his wife and his little kids, they're over there in Iraq. They live in Iraq. And he's an agent of healing. He helps orchestrate kind of like doctors to help heal kids that are born with bad hearts. And a lot of this, he told me, Preston, a lot of the stuff I do is simply a byproduct of living in a war-torn country. I mean, the byproduct of us going over there and fighting bad guys has left all kinds of health problems with people, and the soil is all messed up because of, you know, I don't understand all the science behind it, but he says it's fascinating. And nobody ever talks about that. So he's over there being an agent of healing and peace, sort of in the aftermath of war. So it's like, if Christian, rather than just being sort of loading our guns and going and trying to blow up our enemies, you know, like that's, you know, what we can fight against true evil and promote good in the world by being agents of healing and peace. And again, is that going to stop ISIS? No, he's not going to stop ISIS, but he is going to spread the love of Christ and help establish peace in a war-torn country. And what's cool about that is he serves as a bridge between the Christians and the Muslims there, you know, and has just been an outstanding catalyst in that sense. And again, you have, you know, I just have to keep qualifying this. In no way do I think there's a simple solution to ISIS or here's the one, two, whatever. But, there is a largely anti-Western motif, right, that's driving ISIS largely. Yeah. And it's like, where did that come from? Well, again, let's read history. Go back to how the West, largely America, has been done all kinds of harm to different Arabic nations. I mean, it's fascinating how behind the scenes we have been chipping away at them. And, you know, if Iran had been, in, you know, had agents running around America since the 60s, and if they help establish horrible presidents that oppressed us, like, we would probably have a little anti-Iran, you know, like, feelings about us. So I think, again, we have to look at some of these roots, because if you don't pull it up by the roots, it's just going to grow back.
Mm, yeah. And it's always been a little testy over there, I think we could say, for pretty long time.
yeah.
But in a practical sense, in your own life, how has your study of the topic changed anything practically in your own life?
Yeah, that's really good. For me, it's a... I mean, I live in Boise, Idaho, one of the safest safest cities in America. You know, what's funny is it's a very guns and guns state. Mm-hmm. I don't advertise my book Fight Here. I'd probably get attacked. I mean, people. I'm otherwise somewhat well liked here. I don't want to, you know, ruin it. But I'll still meet people like at church. You know, with like literally two holsters. They're packing guns on each side, and I'm like, hey man, so why do you come to church? You know. Loaded, you know, he's like, well, you know, there's a lot of crazies out there. I'm like, yeah, they're not in Boise, though. In fact, they're not even really in Idaho. In fact, the crazies we have are like you. Yeah, I just, you know, you have a much better chance getting struck by lightning than getting murdered in Boise, Idaho. Again, I'm not saying stuff doesn't happen, but so yeah. Logically, you should walk around with a lightning rod or a rubber, you know, whatever shoes, whatever, protect yourself from lightning, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just this fear-driven narrative that everybody's out to get you and everybody wants to take your stuff and harm you. And it's like, does it happen? Yes. But is it, I think it's way overplayed. Huh. I think it's like 3,000 people die from slipping in a bathtub every year or something. It's like, and yet we're so scared about ISIS coming to Boise or, you know, it's like, come on. Like, I didn't answer your question. In my own life, I find in my own heart, like, I still, even though I wrote the book about it, I still find my immediate knee-jerk reaction against stuff from every level is usually overpower opposition with more power, you know?
Yeah.
Whether it's my kid that doesn't want to obey and therefore I kind of yell louder, like, you know, or it's, you know, if I don't get my way in this or that, or on blogs, social media, somebody attacks me and I'm like, my natural reaction is to overpower opposition with more power. And that's so, you know, for somebody living in a war-torn country, I hope they don't listen to that because they're rolling their eyes saying, wow, you know, I got bullets sailing over my head and you got people making nasty comments on a blog or something, you know. It's like, so I want to recognize the ridiculousness of that, but it's just, I mean, that's just where I live, so I can't, I do have to seek to live this stuff out, and it's going to be on a way smaller scale. But I do believe that information and changing people's thinking and values is hugely significant. So at the same time, I do think speaking about some of this stuff and writing about it and talking about it, I think it is a significant step forward. I don't want to poo-poo that and say, well, that's just academic stuff. I mean, you know, what's funny is that the whole Arab Spring back in 2011, when everybody's toppling these dictators, a few of them, by the way, were through nonviolent revolts, just to throw that in there. You know, it was large. They say the success of all these uprisings was largely due to Twitter and Facebook. The power of speedy information, it wasn't the gun, it wasn't the bomb. I mean, obviously some of those things played a role, but it was the power of information being spread so quickly. And so I do think that, because I get this a lot, like, what do we Christians do? We don't live in a war-torn country here. What do we do? And I say, honestly, just speaking out against the, you know, militarism and evangelicalism, speaking out against some of the ways that people think. And I think that does have ultimate power. And that may actually be chipping away at some of these roots that is causing, you know, ISISes to spring up. So that's only going to happen if you change the way people think. And so I think that we do have a role to play.
Yeah, it really is taking on the mind of Christ. And that's that kind of edges into my territory, which is spiritual formation. And and ultimately, everything is spiritual formation. You're either getting formed in one way or getting formed in a different way. And as we think different, just thinking that there is a different way, that you know, we as Americans, I think we think sometimes this is how Christianity works, the American way. You know, that there's lots of different ways that plays out in different parts of the world. Christianity plays out differently. And just because we've been doing it this one way and married some of these different concepts that are cultural concepts doesn't mean that we've automatically taken on the mind of Christ in those things.
Right.
And so it's good to think critically and put those unpopular ideas out there. Like, wait a minute, does it mean you have to take two holsters and guns to church? Is that important? Is it, you know, and it's funny because, you know, there's that instance with Peter has a sword, and I've always thought, what was he doing with a sword? Did he have a sword all the time? Or was it just, he nervous that night? You know, he's nervous that Jesus is going to get arrested. And then, you know, he whips out his sword, obviously has no idea what he's doing. Cause he doesn't, you know, he just cuts off the ear. And then Jesus is like, what are you doing? And, you know, that's just such a weird little story. And you realize that Jesus is like, we're not going to fight our way out of this arrest.
Right, right. You know? Well, you know, it follows on the heels of that passage in Luke 22. And this one usually gets thrown at me where Jesus says, he who has no sword, let him sell his cloak and go buy a sword. And he's speaking, well, we can get into that, but he's speaking more symbolically there. And then, of course, a couple of the disciples say, hey, look, we have two swords. And Jesus kind of rolls his eyes and says, oh, come on. and it was probably Simon the Zealot who's probably packing. I'm sure he had something hidden. And Peter had a sword. And so obviously he didn't want them to use those swords in a violent way because he disarms Peter immediately when he pulls it out. But
yeah.
That is funny where he was keeping that thing.
I'm sure it was kind of like, you know, he was always jumping the gun, I guess you could say. So it was like, I'm glad you have written on that. And I don't know if you're going to continue to write on that topic or if you feel like that's behind you, that you've covered it already. But it's no wonder that it's coming, that people are trying to speak to you about it again, because it doesn't seem like we understand. And there's more violence in the world now, it seems anyway, than there has been, whether you're talking about terrorist attacks or school shootings or something like that. And so it's kind of our Christian response has to be kind of like deep and profound and meaningful, because I don't think we're really doing our job in the sense of being light in the world. So the other thing I wanted to make sure I mentioned before we wrap things up is that you're a podcaster too, and I wanted you to maybe speak a little bit about what your podcast is about, what it's called, and where people can find it.
Yeah, so my podcast is called Theology in the Raw. And it's actually, I'm on the radio here in Boise every day from 2:15 to 2:30. So it's really short, just a little 14-15 minute window. Mm-hmm. And then those radio shows are uploaded as a podcast. I feel like when I'm doing it, I'm thinking more in terms of the podcast rather than the radio show. Cause it really is a very different demographic. I mean, who listens to Christian radio in the afternoons in Boise, Idaho? That's a different audience than people who are listening to 15-minute podcasts online. So it's Theology in the Raw. I love to talk about the stuff that Noda would like to talk about. And you can tell from the intro of the podcast that it's a different sort of I think the intro alone will scare off a lot of my Christian readers in one way, but we've talked about hell for several weeks. I did a long series on homosexuality. And right now I take questions. You can email my assistant, and then she hands me a list of questions, and I basically just work through those. So the most recent one I worked through was, what do I think about the Roman Catholic Church? Mm-hmm. You know, and this person is raised in an environment where all Catholics are going to hell. And he doesn't seem to agree with that. And he wanted to know what I thought. So my last podcast was talking about that. And I love to answer the questions, respond to the questions that a lot of people aren't really able to ask in church.
And where can that be found, just from your website?
If someone wants to listen? If you go to iTunes, Theology in the Raw, it'll pop right up.
Yeah.
If you Google Theology in the Raw, I also have a blog by the same title, Theology in the Raw. So you can find the link to the podcast there or on my website. I believe my website's actually in the process of being revamped. So I think there might be a podcast link there somewhere. But if you just Googled Press and Sprinkle podcast, I'm sure you can get the link there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that sounds great. And are you pretty active on Twitter? Where are some places people can find you?
Yeah, at Preston Sprinkle is my Twitter handle. My website, PrestonSprinkle.com. My blog, Theology in the Raw. My podcast, Theology in the Raw. So, yeah, I'm in the process of consolidating everything into one website where it's kind of a one-stop shop. So, but yeah, my website has, contact information, books I've written, and all that stuff.
That's great. And I will also put that in the show notes in case anybody's listening to this from my website. But it's been great to share some time with you and delve deeper into this topic. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Lisa. This has been fun.
Yeah, and maybe we can come back again and talk about some more feather ruffling topics.
Yeah, sounds good. I've got a few.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.